The Local Thread. Hello. Greetings. Welcome to A Moment of Truth. I'm Fletcher Word, publisher of The Sojourner's Truth, and today we are going to discuss some things that are happening with healthcare in the Toledo community, some efforts to improve the health of those in this community. Today's discussion will be hosted by The Sojourner's Truth reporter, Alexandria Leatherbury. In today's Moment of Truth, Alexandria will be speaking with several health professionals in the African American community who are working diligently not only to cure what ails those in the community, but perhaps more importantly, prevent some of those uncomfortable, unhealthy things from happening in the first place. Enjoy today's Moment of Truth.
Hello, my name is Alexandria Leatherbury, a reporter for the Sojourner Truth. I'm here to open up our health segment for A Moment of Truth. I really wanted to take this on because the discussion around Black health is growing. I'm hoping to touch a little bit of everything I can in these three episodes to give a total look at how we can address issues within our community from all approaches. I hope the health segment discussions we have during A Moment of Truth spark creativity and innovation around all inequalities as we discuss community solutions to Black health. There's so many things that affect our health as a person that are just not limited to our diagnosis in the doctor room or following a new fitness trend. We can't just talk about going to the gym and eating healthy if we aren't also discussing what gives us accessibility. So today, we will discuss some of the community solutions to Black health with those who are building health equity and shaping access in our community. We'll be chatting with Sonia Flounder McNair, an urban farmer, and Ryan Roslin, a personal trainer and fellow journalist of mine. And a very special guest, the first African-American woman chief of staff for St. Charles Mercy Hospital. I'll finish introducing her later. I'm super excited to dig into that one. But first, here we have Sonia. Hi, Sonia. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Alex. Nice to see you.
It's nice seeing you, too. I've been familiar with you out in the community for a while. Yes. We were just talking about, you know, how this is kind of a full circle moment for us.
So it is.
Thank you for joining me for today.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. I know you'll definitely always give us a moment of truth when it comes to what we put into our bodies in the community, what we eat, what we have access to, and what we've been taught to normalize as our food culture. You have been pivotal in that. You're leading the example of what urban development looks like and reinvesting into our neighborhoods. So I really just want to catch up with you right now and get to know where you are now. And if you could tell a little bit of that history that got you started.
Well, food access is the reason why I started. My core message to my whole mission is that health doesn't start in a doctor's office. It starts in the soil where you access your food, or if it is accessible, your kitchen is a place of healing, and what we have access to within the communities. We have some communities that had little to no access to foods, and we have just basically what people call a food desert. Food deserts are policy outcomes. And when we talk about food deserts, we have a definition of stores that are not in your area or a certain mile radius from your area. But I'm here to teach you that food deserts are still where stores are because farmers produce food. So to have pocket farms or pocket food hubs within a community that are small farms makes it to where you have secure food access. You're one step away from a shipment not coming into a store. So to be able to teach kids that food comes from the land and not from the store has been pivotal.
I actually didn't even think about that and like how, you know, just the delayment of shipment. I definitely considered food access, the fresh food access to those stores being troublesome. And I'm starting to see, to your point of the policy disparities or gaps that we see, we're starting to see like some new funding initiatives actually come around that. So I saw most recently, I think there is some funding coming out around getting fresh food into these stores that are in those food deserts. Are you familiar with that?
I am actually familiar with that. That is being led by the health department, which is doing a corner store initiative to make sure that foods at the corner stores are healthy. They're also connecting your store owners to farmers that they never knew of, because most of our money goes to big brands. And to have a real impact in the community, we need to see the money stay within the communities. So to teach the not only the community, but our restaurant owners and our store owners how to access the best foods, we have water sources and food sources all throughout Ohio, and we're not using them correctly.
And to your point, you are definitely leading the way and teaching that as far as how to make these scalable. So building scalable and state level community solutions. You're doing a lot of work in that. Yes. So I've been on your social media. And
I've actually worked on the state level to create policies that didn't exist to create these farms within the communities. You needed policy to put up a hoop house. You needed policy to basically do anything that you wanted to do as far as farming within a city. Farming was pushed out rurally, and it was something that wasn't really done in the city. You had small gardens, community gardens, which is different from a farm that's registered with USDA. So me being a Black woman in Lucas County, having a farm registered in Lucas County is one of the few 2% that we represent within the USDA. So we are a very small number when it comes down to representation. So women, minority, we represent the 2%.
Well, thank you for being a part of that 2%, because as you know, that, again, helps our access.
And shout out to Senator Hudson that is really trailblazing and making arrangements for policies to be made to actually help the Ohio farmers all throughout Ohio. We have a need for support.
What is that difference between the community garden and having a USDA farm?
So the difference between the two is a community garden is free for all. You come, you hopefully volunteer, and you support the initiative, and you take food as it becomes available. When you have a farm, my farm is registered with USDA, and it gives us a lot of resources to access. Like one, we can have very, I would say, access to loans at a low interest rate. You also have access to resources like hoop houses that can be set up by USDA for free. You can ask for irrigation systems. You can ask for certain things that you can't ask on a city level. So to go and be able to have resources that are not within the city, accessible within the city, being with USDA give you some extra reach.
Awesome. What are some of those resources that you've been able to bring to the city? I know we have, again, the Youth Farmers Market. That's kind of where I met you. Mm-hmm. And I see you are working on a second green space here. So
yes, we actually had just worked on getting a, that's another part of the policy, is no such thing as zoning for urban agriculture. So you have to go and get what you call a SUP, which is a special use permit for your land. And you can get that through the city, and you get permission basically to advance your operation. So what we've seen now is what I've been able to do so far. Now that I have the special use permit, we can go as far as this summer we're working with the county to have programming accessible for all. So ADA accessibility for raised beds and access to the farmhouse. We're going to work on that with not only our youth farmers, but some community partners as well. So we want to be able to bring in anyone that wants to access food and the programs to learn how to produce.
That is so awesome. What gave you this drive? Like, I think I watched a little bit on your website. You gave a little bit of background as far as your own journey as discovering food as medicine. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Back in, I want to say 2015, I had a very scary encounter, and I almost lost my life. And I got out of the hospital maybe at close to 100 pounds. I was very small. I was ill, and all I wanted to do was get back home to my 4x4 raised bed. I knew what that food had the power of doing. And when I got home, food started to heal me. And I didn't want to keep that to myself. So I wanted to teach children, and not only children, but entire families, the power of food and knowing food not as we've been introduced to it. Food has such healing components to it that we only use it just to get full. And we're happy when we're full.
Yes.
But we need to know how to go to, for instance, ginger if we have a stomach ache, mm-hmm. or if we have digestive issues and want to drink it before a meal to help digest the foods that we usually get. They call itis, or when you want to lay out after you eat. Food's supposed to energize you. It's supposed to sustain you. And so you have to learn how to eat the right foods at the proper time, seasonal foods, to be able to get the maximum benefits from them.
Yes, I am such a foodie girl myself, but I'm learning that I need to eat. I'm saying eat for fuel instead of to be full. So that's like my new saying right now. It's trying to eat for that fuel more. Those things that make me feel good are going to give me that energy. I'm still a foodie at heart and mm-hmm. have your pleasures, but I think once you start learning how your body processes things and what it actually needs and when it needs it is so, so important. So I definitely agree with that point. A new thing I've been doing, too, is like walking after you eat.
Yes.
That gets, you know, the food to moving and things like that. So I think that even helps in knowing your digestive.
Total wellness.
Mm-hmm. Total wellness. Yeah, that is definitely like what I'm trying to touch on in this podcast. So I was super excited when you said you could be here today. I can't tell. So in working with those families and, you know, definitely the youth, how are you starting to see the attitudes shift towards nutritional eating?
Well, we had the opportunity this year to go into school and a few schools and to introduce the kids to food during the time where we were told that some of the kids will have behavioral issues, or it was mostly like, hey, we're going to prepare you for this, and this is how the kids act, and welcome. And we were like, okay, this is great. Food had a power within the classroom. Being able to introduce children to food in the classroom has been empowering, and it has been powerful. Hydroponically, we've been growing inside of the classroom. So when they come into the classroom and they're hungry or they haven't eaten at school because they complain about the school meals, or they haven't eaten at home because of sometimes there's not food at home. It has been very instrumental to see kids during the day have nutrition. And when you have a hydroponic unit that's growing herbs and food and they come right in and they know what to do with it, has been very powerful for the kids. One thing I will tell you about kids, they know what makes them feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And they will go back to it over and over. So when they're introduced early to nutrition, they will always revert back to it whenever they're sick or whenever they're working out or just using it preventatively. You can use food preventatively. So to teach them at a young age is going to help with genetics that they're expecting to come. We can eat to prevent. And so the kids have been very responsive with that.
Absolutely. I love that you bring up prevention because a lot of times, like, we're told things like diabetes or something can't be necessarily genetic. Actually, in my own experience, I've had, you know, a long history of diabetes. So mm-hmm. I am more susceptible to that. So I have to, you know, eat a little bit more mindful
right.
If I want to pretty much deter that.
Keep it at bay. Keep it at bay.
Mm-hmm.
Because those foods, the processed foods, the things that we're given out in abundance will wake up dormant issues.
Mm-hmm.
And to keep them dormant, we have to, like you said, total wellness. Take that walk. Be mindful of what you're eating. And make sure that you're not just keeping this information to yourself, but you're making sure that your families are able to come along with you, where it's not a chore to be healthy.
Yes, absolutely. I definitely think that community support is so, so, so big. I'm actually hoping to get into that a little bit later today. So before we wrap up today, I just want to get just how you really look forward to addressing these issues and creating more opportunities to educate on preventative care in your work.
I am hoping that we are able to raise the next generation of farmers. I am hoping that we are able to move into more structured learning environments, more schools, because when nutrition is limited, you have bodies that are not well, you enter into survival mode, and then you have your immunity that drops. We have inflammatory issues that can manifest, and mental health. Once mental health suffers, disease become easier to grow into the body. So when we reclaim food as medicine, as a community, we reclaim power over our health. So this is just another form of health care. And I am so grateful that people are willing to embrace food as medicine and as health care, because if we do embrace that, we welcome prevention in our lives and we will be better off as a community.
I'm just going to wrap up here. Sonya, I thank you so much and appreciate you sharing your story and education with us. We have learned a lot, and I am thankful we are able to have these conversations while we have these resources available you're providing. Absolutely. I hope that what we can really take away from this conversation today, that these community solutions are being built by people like Sonya with yes. Arend Holistics. And we don't have to wait to make a change when it is forever ongoing. Arend Holistics is an example of the change in action. Your work is so important to us, Sonya. And I hope the youth that have been able to be a part of your work carries it forward to the next generation.
So do I. Thank you for having me. And if you would like to volunteer or come and visit our farm, you can reach us at urbanholistics.org. And holistics does have a W in front of it, meaning to make us all whole.
Awesome. Thank you again. Welcome back to A Moment of Truth. My next guest leads community solutions to healing the body through movement. Personal trainer Ryan Rollison is here to give some wisdom on preventative factors of movement. Obviously, we know exercise helps us lose weight and can maybe even be a confidence boost. But beyond aesthetics, it's how we manage stress, how we build strength for mobility, and a quality life. When you have an understanding of your family, medical history, body function, and body type, the fitness journey becomes even more foundational in breaking those generational health diagnoses. We need a moment of truth to talk about how fitness can reduce risk factors, improve mental health, and build bodies that last. Hi, Ryan. Thank you for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what you do in that personal training space.
Well, I help people improve their life through fitness. It's not always about losing weight. or getting to a certain size, I focus more on how you feel. People, you know, there's people that have ailments that come to me because, you know, they're out of shape, they're heavy, they need to feel better. I focus more on helping people feel better opposed to just losing weight and gaining muscle tissue.
I definitely agree with the feeling better component. I was just speaking with Sonia about how nutrition helps complement that, and not only helps you feel better, but it can aid to that movement. So, you know, sometimes when it comes to muscle repair and things like that, nutrition definitely affects that. Do you have any like knowledge or anything that you can share with us about how nutrition affects your movement?
Yeah, there's a saying that goes, you can't out-train a bad diet. And that's like one of the truest statements ever made. I believe that nutrition is the basis to everything. Whether you're trying to drop body fat, whether you're trying to gain muscle tissue, just lead a healthier lifestyle, nutrition is 90% of the battle. Movement, of course, you know, helps with everything that you're trying to do physically, but your nutrition is the sound piece to the whole puzzle. I believe that, and you can research this, it's, you know, controlling blood sugar levels or glucose levels, keeping them on an even keel most of the time is what helps everything along.
Yes, I definitely agree. You, especially at your first point of not being able to out-train a bad diet. I kind of sometimes feel the more and longer that you have been in shape or, you know, athletic, it's like the more accountable your body holds you in on your nutrition. And so it makes you be even more proactive in eating in a way that will prevent you from not being able to perform athletically. So, yes.
And the opposite holds true to that too. If you don't have good solid nutrition, you fall into a place where it's hard for you to get back on track or to even get on track. And most people think that, you know, they have to go into the gym and spend hours a day. This deters a lot of people, females especially, because they feel, you know, if they lift weights, it's going to make them big and bulky. If they lift weights, they're going to look like a man. And that's the farthest from the truth. Weightlifting is one of the, if not the best things you can do for your body, for your muscle tissue, for burning fat, for using glucose stores, for building bone density. You know, a lot of women don't realize, and I'm specifically talking to women right now, weight training and the pressure that you put on the bones will help you, you know, combat osteoporosis and stuff like that.
Absolutely. And like to your point of that consistency, I took like a month off one time from the gym and I was just like, never again. Right. So I think for about like a year now, I have been just like, I don't want to feel that again. Yeah. So I try not to like go longer than a week or something like that because I know that will only set me back probably farther than I was when, you know, before I took the break.
Yeah, muscle atrophies relatively fast, but the good thing is that it has memory and it comes back pretty quick too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you take some time off, if you have to take time off, just be, you know, have the knowledge to know that when you get back in there, you're not going to be doing what you were doing at first, but it'll come back a lot quicker than, you know, not doing anything at all.
I definitely agree, especially like during the holiday season. I tried to take, because I was in a mode that I wanted to reset. So I tried to take like an intentional, like almost pacing breaks. So instead of like my normal four times a week, I was like going maybe like only two times to still keep that muscle memory or keep conditioned, as some athletes would say, stay in like conditioned mode. So that's kind of how I looked at it. You want to share anything like as far as like,
well, holiday time is really hard. It's hard for a lot of people. The average person puts on like 10 pounds, 5 to 10 pounds during the holiday season. And, you know, it's so easy to go into work or, you know, your house and your bacon or whatever, and they got cookies sitting all over the place. And you know what? One's not going to hurt. But then you walk by again and, you know, two's not going to hurt. And you just, you know, you keep going and keep going. Before you know it, it's New Year's and you're 10 pounds heavier than you were, you know, around Thanksgiving time. And now you're panicking because, you know, you're setting your New Year's resolution to lose weight. And most people, you know, fail at that. You know, I think it's like past 2 weeks, everybody's done with their New Year's resolutions. And I think that just having a conscious mindset of what you eat, and I can't stress enough, you know, I'm going to backtrack about your glucose levels. You know, glucose releases insulin and it stores fat. And, you know, the more you have a wavy spike of glucose, the more body fat you're going to store. And that's why weightlifting, it makes your body much more insulin sensitive, and you will, or glucose sensitive, insulin sensitive, and you will use that and not store it as body fat. So like if you're a type 2 diabetic, one of the best things for you to do is to lift weights, because it helps you utilize more of your glucose.
What are some things that built that consciousness for you? Like any routines or anything that you follow?
I've been doing this for 40 years. So I've competed in bodybuilding for 20. I've promoted. I was head of fitness for the military at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And it's just over the years and over the time, you know, I see how, you know, it impacts. And there's more. There's so much research out now, you know, about insulin and glucose and how it affects your body and all the things that it does for you. I'm not a doctor, you know, by any stretch, but, you know, research and understand and know your body and how it's going to adapt to certain things that you eat and certain things that you don't eat and, you know, meal timing and prep and all that stuff. So, you know, it's you have to research your own self to see how you respond to things.
Absolutely. I agree. I definitely started just the more that I was like, you know, understanding what my goals really were with my fitness journey. Mm-hmm. That helped me be able to conduct like a little bit of better research and understanding, you know, like how glucose is processed through the body. So experimenting with like patterns like, okay, if I eat carbs 3 times a week, you know, how does this bloat me versus once? So that's kind of been some kind of almost like experimenting.
Yeah. And that's a huge thing I tell my clients, you know your body, learn your body. My doctor, I was able to get a glucose monitor, just not because, you know, I'm worried about becoming a diabetic, but I wanted to see how what I ate affected my blood sugar levels. And it's just, you know, it's so amazing to have that knowledge at your doorstep right now, and people don't utilize it. People don't understand. If you go for a walk, just a 10-minute walk after you eat each meal, your blood sugar drops significantly, mm-hmm. and you feel better, and it stops the process of storing fat. And mm-hmm. you know, people just need to be aware, like I said, be aware of what your body does, you know, when you consume certain things.
You mentioned that you got like you started in bodybuilding and things mm-hmm. like that. How did you get started in that?
My dad owned a gym in Sandusky. I'm from Sandusky originally. Okay. So I started competing in bodybuilding when I was 17 years old.
Oh, awesome.
So, and then I carried it on from there. And
did you do sports before that, or were you?
I played some football, and I wrestled. And then I'm hate to admit this, but I'm not much of a team player. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm kind of like my, you know, I hate depending on other people for things, and bodybuilding was just like an outlet for me to just do my own, get my own results. What I put into it, I get out of. And, you know, it's you know, people say, oh, they don't want to be a bodybuilder, they don't want to do that, and that's fine. But if you're working out, you're a bodybuilder. You may not compete, but you're working on your body. And people need to, you know, grasp that concept of, you know, just because you go in and work out doesn't mean you're going to get, you know, on stage. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody thinks when you go into a gym that, so I started training people when I was 15 years old mm-hmm. in my dad's gym. And it took off for me. I didn't want to do it, you know, because it was like expected of me because my dad owned a gym. But I was good at it. I had a passion for it, and I enjoy it. I like seeing people get results. And results vary, like just from being able to get up out of your chair easier, sleeping better, you know, being more mobile. There's just so many different results. But everybody thinks that when you work out, you know, oh, they want to lose weight. They want to lose weight. They want to, you know, gain muscle tissue. Those are great. But it's functionality that you need to also focus on.
And like you said, it can treat maybe some health issues or, you know, problems that you're experiencing. Like, I was actually having knee issues for a while. So I used to run track. Well, I was actually in shot put and discus because I wasn't very good on the track or very fast. But now I do 5Ks. So we've gotten into running. We trained as a distance runner. My coaches didn't believe in me. Anyways. So I maybe would have been better then. But to your point, you know, I was having a knee issue and because I had had some, you know, weight gain and things like that. And with that training, I was able to, you know, training for the 5Ks and things, I was able to really strengthen my knee to kind of carry the weight that I had. So, and that was something I really didn't even realize how much my weight gain honestly had became an issue until, you know, I started running and things like that and feeling how, you know, that movement was, you know, the impact on my body.
Right.
It was taking, because I was no longer really in good shape.
Well, a pound of weight on your body is 5 pounds on your joints.
Mm.
So, you know, the more weight you gain, the harder it is on your joints. And then, you know, people don't understand that too. They're like, oh, I got bad knees. Well, yeah, get some of that weight off of you. You know, and your knees will get better. And that's you know, now, unless
people
you got...
People don't want to hear that, but yeah, it's the truth.
Unless you got some bad, you know, arthritis or, you know, some tendon problems or degeneration, it's a weight problem for a lot of people.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of things, like, you know, we won't completely avoid. Like, there's some things that will just come with, you know, our age and time. But we can sometimes prolong or deter those things with just being proactive in our healthcare. So, you know, movements, nutrition, and all those things are a part of the healthcare. It's just not showing up at the doctor's office. So I kind of want to get into what preventative care kind of means to you when it comes to movement and when it comes to fitness and working out.
Preventative care, I think it's very, very basic. I think it's so simple, but everybody makes it complex. Move, get up, move. You know, everybody sits around all day and, you know, complains they're gaining weight or, you know, they're sore or this or that. Move. Motion is lotion for your joints. Motion is lotion. And that's, you know, and what you're putting in sugar, oh, sugar kills your joints. Inflammation is, if sugar feeds every ailment in your body that you have, from cancer to joint problems to arthritis, and it's just an inflammatory, I'll call it a drug, you know, because people can't seem to kick it. If you can cut your sugar in half, that would be such a big milestone and big step for people. That's a huge preventative thing for, you know, getting in shape. And it's very hard to get people to cut back on their sugars because it's such a staple. You know, sugars are carbohydrates. You know, sugars, carbohydrates turn into sugars. Your body uses them, but, you know, it shoots your insulin levels up. And if you're not moving and you're not using it, you're going to gain weight. And it's going to cause other problems.
Yeah, and I think to your point of the connection of, you know, those outside influences, as we're, like, building those muscles, it's influencing the inside. So, you know, things like your heart. So strengthening your heart muscles and things like that, you can maybe be able to prolong any health issues with that.
Yes. Sadly, I just had a cousin who's younger than me. Was 50, died of heart problems. And I just had another friend who I'm going to see who just died of a heart problem. He's 3 years older than me. And, you know, I can't stress enough just the importance of taking care of yourself and just moving and, you know, your cardiovascular. Go for a walk. I mean, do something. Just, you know, people are sitting around dying. Our nutrition's horrible. The food we eat is horrible. You know, I know you had the lady on earlier about the organic garden stuff. I mean, you have to eat clean. You have to take care of yourself. You're not going to make it on Oreos and potato chips.
Right. And I think what some people find the hardest about the fitness journey is staying motivated. So in staying motivated on your journey, something that was game changing for me was group fitness. So going to yoga classes. I actually started yoga at home, just going going on YouTube and pulling out a mat at home. But when the pandemic came around, obviously we were all like striving for that human connection. So I started going to classes and that really changed my mind frame in how personal the journey should be, because it's like once you go to classes you kind of see like everybody struggles with this, right? Like everybody kind of struggles with fitness a little bit and having that motivation and trying to push themselves. So can you just share a little bit of how you've seen maybe personal training maybe versus group fitness and that consistency in those spaces?
I think that group fitness is great. I run fit camps. I call them fit camps because if I call them boot camps and people know I was head of military, they think I'm going to kill them. And that's not, you know, that's not my intention. I think it's very good group settings, especially if you have a hard time getting motivated because you have other people, like you said, that are in there struggling just like you or that aren't struggling and can influence and help you, you know, when you can kind of build a community that way or an accountability with each other and be like, hey, are you coming tomorrow? Yeah. Or, you know, I think group sessions are good, especially for people that need them. And, you know, with me doing the personal training, that's a sort of an accountability that people want to come to, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Ryan, for sharing your knowledge today and just what you do. How can we stay connected with you?
You can reach me through just send me an email at dreambodies419@gmail.com. And my website's down right now, but I'll get it back up.
Awesome. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
When we hear a doctor visit, it can feel as if it has some trauma tied to it. Trauma of exploitation, neglect, and disproportionate access to appropriate care. Because of the historical injustices that have led to traumatizing events, it has led to a stigmatized relationship between African Americans and doctors. However, we're seeing a shift for more proactive and preventative care advocacy through doula work, increasing awareness of early detection benefits, and food medicine programs for risk reduction. That shift didn't happen by accident. It happens when trust is rebuilt, when care is led by people who understand both the history and the humanity of communities they serve. It happens when leadership reflects lived experience and when advocacy moves from the margins to the center of healthcare decision making. Today, we are witnessing that transformation in real time. Those leaders who are not only redefining care, but reshaping the systems themselves. I am thrilled to be sitting here with a leader setting the example by being the first African-American chief of staff for St. Charles Mercy's Hospital, Dr. Tanya Baldwin. Welcome, Tanya.
Thank you.
How are you today?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm so excited to have you here today. I want to just open up and you telling us about what you do and how you got there.
Okay, so I'm trying to make this as quick as possible, but I kind of established that I wanted to become a physician around the age of 14. I always loved children and became fascinated with the human body. And the more I got exposed, the more I dug my heels in. And so definitely got exposed to some different programs and went through college, did well in math and science. And so I decided to go to med school, forged away, made that happen. I ended up going to MCO. It was called MCO then. It's now University of Toledo Medical Center, and graduated and wanted to stay locally. So I did my residency at Mercy Family Practice here in town. And at that time, it was appropriate. We rotated all over the city and all the different hospitals. So got a wide exposure and experience. And then when it was time to look for a permanent job, I applied, of course, with Mercy, and I found the perfect thing because I had my middle daughter the last year of residency, so as I was graduating. And so started out as part-time and then went into full-time practice as she got older and continued from there. And so now I am one of the few family practitioners that still does hospital rounds and sees patients in the office in an ambulatory setting, and just stepped into a new leadership role at St. Charles. But that is where my home base is. I did a lot of time and spent a lot of nights on call in the hospital, and so it's like my second home.
Yes, absolutely. And congratulations again on your new role. What made you want to take on that role?
I have been raised to be a leader. I am the oldest of three daughters, and I have a mother who is a trailblazer, but we grew up in the Dayton, Ohio area. And so my mother happened to become the first African-American and first female common pleas court judge in Montgomery County. And so it's kind of in my genetics. And then when it came time to the field that I love, the career that I love, I have been dedicated and loyal, and the staff at the hospital recognized that and have promoted me to this role.
Absolutely. Come on, legacy. I love that. I love that. That is amazing. So you said that, like, at 14, you knew you wanted to go into the medical industry. When did that happen? Like, what kind of was like, when did that light go off for you?
It was really interesting. It was my mother who posed the question to me, because we were talking about, because I was starting high school, and she was like, what do you want to be? And I loved kids, and I was a big nurturer because I'm the oldest of three girls. And I said, oh, Mom, I think I might want to own and run a daycare center or something like that. She knew that I did well in school, and she was like, well, what do you think about being a pediatrician? And I thought, I never thought of that. And then as I got into it, especially after medical school and everything, I thought, with my advisors and mentors, I want to be able to deliver the babies and then keep them in my practice. You know, how can I do that? And it was suggested to me to look at family medicine. And it was a wonderful experience, because in residency, I did do that. I delivered babies and then took care of whole families. But ultimately, when I got out into practice, family practitioners, which is the newer version of a general practitioner, they don't really deliver babies anymore because we have OBGYNs. But I did have the experience of having a child I delivered bring their child to me for office visit. And I was like, oh, it's so special, because that's why I chose family medicine.
Absolutely. I do agree with that special feeling in working with the same people. Although I'm not a medical professional and doing the important stuff, as a photographer in the field, I love when I'm able to take a maternity photo, right? And then yeah. I'm taking the family photos a little couple of like months later after they're born with the newborn there in person. And it's just like, oh, wow, I'm watching this family grow. Mm-hmm. I just, honestly, a friend that I've had since seventh grade, I just did her 10-year anniversary, wedding anniversary. And I was just like, oh, wow. Like, it brought tears to my eyes.
Yes.
To know that I have watched this person go from when we were preteens to, you know, adults, and see her almost in her light. What kind of feeling does it give you to kind of be able to experience that, seeing children grow in your office almost?
That is why we do it. It brings you so much satisfaction. Of course, not every patient is like that, and there's difficult ones and challenges. But what keeps me going is the breakthroughs. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some people, I believe that, of course, I am not for everyone. You have to find your person. But if you trust me and we have this relationship, I'm in it with you. I treat you like a family member. That's the reason why I chose family medicine. And so when we get those breakthroughs and you come again and again and we, you know, get your blood pressure down and we control your diabetes and you lose weight, we celebrate. You know, I celebrate with my patients in my office.
Okay, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask, like, how you establish that relationship, because especially when there is a unfavorable diagnosis and things like that, how do you navigate and keep people, because sometimes people, when they get those diagnoses, don't like want to follow with treatment. So how do you work through those things? How do you navigate that?
That is an in-depth question, because one is I am a very empathetic person. And so everything is energy. And my patients know they can feel and discern when I'm really invested or it's just going through information. Secondly, as I go in my life, I am open about sharing. I am recently a breast cancer survivor. And so I am a bigger advocate for the screening tests. And I share with my patients so that they understand I'm not just your practitioner, your doctor telling you what to do. I am practicing what I preach for me personally and sharing with you. If we catch it early, there is a great outcome, but we have to know, we have to find out, we have to go through this, and I'm here with you and will be, you know, till we follow it through all the way.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, that is necessary to be able to find that point of connection of where I relate to you. And I'm sure having your own journey surviving breast cancer, I'm so glad you were sharing that with us. So thank you for that. You have your own challenges in, like, I might not feel the best today. And, you know, I might not have the most empathy to give. How did you build yourself up in those moments to still keep showing up for your patients?
You know, I have always been an optimist, and my mother would always share, always from the beginning, from a little child, I would make people speak to me. And I always had a lot of friends, you know, around me. And I think that that has been nurtured and cultivated and reinforced the longer I live. And so I make it a point, when I say I practice what I preach, I'm trying to make sure I get as much balance as I can with all the pieces to keep myself whole, so that if my cup is full, I can pour into other people's cup.
That is one of my favorite sayings, is like, you can't pour from an empty cup. You have to be able to know what refills you and replenishes you to be able to keep giving throughout the day, especially when you're in a public service or, you know, working within the community. So I do want to like transition a little bit to like what we have been overall talking in today with is preventative care. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we may have to navigate these health diagnoses. There's no way of fully preventing things, but we can help have some deterrence or help shape those things to not be as bad. So with that, you know, we have discussed, you know, fitness and nutrition. But part of that is going to the doctor's office, and we shouldn't just be waiting until our arm is falling off.
Exactly.
You know, we should, you know, really be taking our advice of our doctors and our healthcare facilitators early on. And so I guess what would just your advisory be in that space, and how to communicate that importance to, you know, patients and, you know, just our community in general?
The biggest point that I can say is, because of how the health system works, it is very important for you to establish with your primary care provider. And that could be a internal medicine physician or nurse practitioner or physician's assistant, family medicine, but someone that is the quarterback of your healthcare team. Mm. And so that means that you just go at least once a year, you know, to establish that rapport, get a physical exam once a year and a once over, and get that basis established so that when something comes up, one, you have somebody checking regularly. Mm-hmm. Two, you're establishing a relationship over time. Mm-hmm. And three, so that when something comes up, you have a built-in advocate. Mm-hmm. As a primary care physician, my regular patients, if something comes up, I know who I'm going to refer them to. I know what tests, you know, I want to order, what to do to investigate and find out what our next steps are. And that's crucial.
I love that you said investigate, because sometimes, you know, we are starting to have more of the conversation, as I mentioned in the beginning of this conversation, of us not feeling heard in the medical offices. Taking that intentional time to investigate, I think it just, it lets the patient know that they are being heard and that there is a more, I just guess that legwork of, for care for them. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Absolutely. I mean, you don't know everything right off the top. So a patient comes in and they have questions. You know, I have memorized a lot, but I need to, you know, if they ask a question and I don't know the answer off the top of my head, I need to find that answer because that's what they're coming for. And I'm always thinking, okay, if this is my mother, if this is my brother, if this is my sister, you know, what would I want for them? And so you go to look for, if I can't help you, let me point you in the right direction and make this referral here, or we need to do this. And a lot of times, if you establish a relationship over time, long term, and can explain the answers to the patient, they will do what you request.
And I think the important part, too, is also in, you know, having those conversations and relationships, also the patient is getting some documentation or just some track record of, you know, steps they've been taking to investigate themselves of what's going on. And I think that's an important piece, too, to ensure that you are, I guess, receiving the help, like you're seeing maybe progress or change or, I don't know, I could be wrong in that space. But I guess my thought is to, in the case that, you know, a patient doesn't feel that their questions are being answered, I guess, what kind of steps should they be taking?
You really do have to advocate for yourself and trust your intuition. If you are uncomfortable and don't feel that you're getting satisfactory answers, I would encourage you to calmly, you know, restate your questions. And if you feel like there's just not any headway going, yet you look for an alternative primary care provider.
And just before we wrap up here, I just want to know what you kind of look forward to in the future of your position and how we can stay connected with you.
Absolutely. I have my primary office is on the east side affiliated with St. Charles in Oregon, Ohio. That's Mercy Bay Meadows Family Medicine. And I'm sure if you are looking me up on the Mercy Health portal, I am right there. You can find my information. I am very excited to step into the new role and see what kind of impact I can make. One thing on my agenda is to have a CME symposium that's all about women's health.
Okay.
And some different things like that.
Okay, awesome. We will definitely be looking out for that. Thank you so much. I appreciate you joining us here today, Dr. Baldwin. And I look forward to just keep chatting with you.
Absolutely.
So closing out today, a moment of truth on community solutions to Black health, I hope one thing is clear. Black health is not just a single conversation. Thank you for joining us today and share this episode. Keep this conversation going on in your community and join us next time for a moment of truth.
The Local Thread is a production of WGTE Public Media. Episodes can be heard weeknights at 7 on FM 91 or anytime at WGTE.org.